Has anyone here ever heard of the game Pace Layers Bingo? Got a few laughs, some spread. So okay, I'm gonna explain the game. So Pace Layers is this sort of theoretical construct that tends to pop up on slide decks whenever you start talking about sort of system level stuff. It's this illustration that keeps on coming back, and the sort of jokey thing to do is to drink whenever that slide comes up. So it's a drinking game, basically, and we're going to play it today. Just so you know, I am the last speaker, so inevitably a lot of the topics that I'm going to talk about have been talked about previously today. But I think and hope that there will be some, like Jeremy said, like the nerdy details, that will perhaps be new. We'll see. Let's start. All right. Bingo. Oh, Jeremy's got it. He knows how the game works now. All right. This is the pace layering model from Stuart Brand's book, Clock of the Long Now. It's one of those sort of conceptual lenses that you can apply to any complex phenomenon, often known as systems. So the idea is we have inner slower layers that power the outer faster layers, but the outer faster layers are the more innovative layers, and they in turn sort of have this slow feedback loops that in time changes the inner layers. So that's like the figure in a very brief introduction. I'm using it as a super stupid way to introduce myself. I'm slow. I'm super slow. Sadly, without the power of the inner layers, I'm just like slow on the uptake. It takes me a while to like settle on a view of things, like what do I really think about this thing? I tend to go back and forth many, many different times. In fact, I'm so slow that it's taken me 11 years to write this talk. It's true. It started actually right here in Brighton in 2008. For an internship with the lovely people at Clear Left. So we have Andy Budd and Rich, and then that guy. That's Jeremy Keith. Maybe you've heard of him. So, you know, 2008, those were the days, right? Web 2.0 was a big thing. The Web Standards War was maybe one, we think, maybe. We thought the border image would be super useful. That did not happen. And sort of Jeremy looked a little bit like Professor Snape's kooky brother. If we enhance, sort of CSI style, we can see that Jeremy's hair wasn't quite Snape black, but it was actually just started turning silver, right? So it feels like yesterday, all of a sudden, it's 11 years later, my hair is turning silver, and here I am giving a talk, coming back to Brighton. So that has nothing to do with anything, but anyway. Another thing from that time, I got to work a little bit alongside Natalie Down, who was working there as a developer at the time. I'd never met someone with such a thorough approach to writing CSS and HTML. Amazing. And I saw Natalie give a presentation at BarCamp Brighton that year. It was originally titled Maintainable CSS, but she renamed it last minute to CSS Systems, which was her framing on how to write good front-end code, basically. It wasn't just code. It was about naming conventions, editor setups, maintenance, and also like transferring the principles of the system to other people working on the same code base, etc. So I was like, whoa, this is good stuff. It definitely set something in motion in me about like how do we do that in a good way. So that's sort of where my story starts. Like, why am I standing here? It's basically because of what happened back then and that talk, for example. So in our industry and in our community, lots have happened since then. A lot of stuff that other speakers have talked about, like all these tools and frameworks that have appeared, like BEM and SMAX, and then like style guides and all that stuff. So we're using more and more like stuff to create modular and reusable designs, and we discuss it and we document it, and et cetera, et cetera. So, like, we have web style guides, component libraries, all that stuff. So, it makes sense to have names for the collection of things. Like, what are we doing as an aggregate? So, when we started talking about design systems a few years ago, rather than perhaps web style guides primarily or component libraries, I felt that tug of, like, yes, this is important. This is something that's good. Let's investigate this. I couldn't quite articulate why that was the case. But based on our focus, they seem to be something we build, right? So what I was thinking then. Whoops. Here we have two incredibly big words, literally and figuratively, design and system. So we smashed those together and, like, good, we did it. Mostly they still seem to mean component libraries or style guides, but you know better. And that was something that I got a little caught up on. Like, as a community, it's evident from, like, pretty much all speakers today, and we probably all agree that they are definitely something more, but we still talk about, like, here's how you build a design system in React. And should we base our design system on material design? For example, Una showed how material has evolved to be much more configurable these days, so maybe that's getting a lot better than it used to be. Anyway, these high-end sort of examples on this slide that Yaeli also mentioned, for example, they definitely represent design systems. I just don't necessarily think they are design systems. And I think we might be doing ourselves a bit of a disservice if we talk about them as if they were. So because of this, like, hang-up on semantics, basically, I've spent some time in the last couple of years wandering about this landscape around design systems, trying to find some landmarks to navigate by, and I thought I'd try and bring you along that same journey in this talk. So it's basically a tour of my design systems bookmarks folder or search history or whatnot, so bear with me for a while. When trying to understand what a design system really is and what a system really is, it felt only natural to sort of go straight to the source. So I'd heard of something called systems thinking, and I decided to find out more. So systems thinking, turns out, it's literally the discipline dedicated to understanding what complex dynamic systems really are, but in an abstract sense, not just one system, but every, like, all kinds of systems. So the ideas come from system dynamics. It's a modeling approach from the 1960s. It started out as a way to, like, optimize factory efficiency in the 60s, or quite close to the stuff that Danielle was mentioning previously. So lots of, like, boxes and arrows stuff and math and equations. So, like, very modernist. Later on, the label systems thinking was popularized by people like Donella Meadows, applying the same kind of modeling to things like ecosystems and climate change and economics and urban planning, for example. So she wrote a book called Thinking in Systems, and there she defines a system as a set of related components that work together in a particular environment to perform whatever functions are required to achieve the system's objective. So to me, this definition, like the paste layers model we saw earlier, can be applied to almost any complex thing, and it's a bit like when somebody teaches you about typographic kerning, you sort of can't unsee it, you start seeing systemness everywhere. And there are a few tricks to doing that, I think. The first trick of thinking in systems is that the boundary of what can be considered a system are pretty much arbitrary. In reality, everything is made up of one giant system that we call existence, and there's, like, an infinite number of potential subsystems. But it's up to us where we decide to draw the system boundaries. There's a lot of talk in this context, like systems thinking context, about modeling systems and not necessarily discovering systems or even creating systems. So this modeling starts with something that can be viewed as a wholeness. So if we take the example of a cow in this quote, it makes sense to study a cow as a system, for example. Dividing it in half, not a really a good way of studying the halves after that, I think. We could also include the food that the cow eats as part of the system. That could be natural, like it's part of how the cow works. But we should probably just model that as, like, external input. Like, in general, cows eat this type of thing, and we still end up with a pretty good picture of how cows work. So we need to figure out where to draw the line and what to model as external. So there might be an opposite situation. For example, if we're studying bacteria, it might make sense to study that as colonies rather than individual organisms, for example. I don't know if there are any, like, microbiologists in the audience. Don't at me. So again, but it's a matter of perspective, and it's a matter of human perspective, how we define a system. So systems thinking goes through, like, a general view of how systems are constructed. So it's super high level, but they have discrete subparts that they call elements, made from matter or information. I think that's an important thing to keep in mind. Groupings of similar types of elements and like aggregates are called stocks. And then we have system functions that change the system by redistributing elements between stocks. They're called flows. We recognize that from our daily lives, I think. And when a stock causes a change in itself, we call that a feedback loop. And the final ingredient, which is super important, is time. There are always delays in a system where something like some change propagates between all the stocks and flows and elements, for example. So, simple example. Of a system here. It's an ecosystem. We have stocks of bunnies. They are, through a feedback loop, creating more bunnies. And while attracting a larger stock of predators, creating less bunnies and so on. So a stable system will have mechanisms like that, keeping the system at equilibrium, whereas an unstable system will have some kind of runaway change that causes the system to tear itself apart. So systems thinking places a lot of emphasis on that system behavior does not emerge from having a collection of things, but rather the relationships between the things and how they affect the whole of the system over time. So one important consequence of that is tweaking the arrows of the system is perhaps more effective than tweaking the boxes of the system or the elements, if you will. So to tie this in with design systems, the relationships between design patterns, components, business goals, designers, end users is a much more powerful aspect of system behavior than, for example, the components themselves. And it also puts us in the frame of mind to start thinking about life cycles, not just what we have now, but what we might need later or might no longer need, for example. So if we start viewing the system not as a collection of things, but as a process, it sort of follows that if it's the system that produces, refines, and maintains design, it turns out that every organization has a design system, whether it's deliberate design system or an accidental design system. I don't think that's good enough of a definition for anyone. I think we can pretty much all agree. But I think this quote from Nathan Curtis brings it down to earth for me a little bit, and it rhymes well with what Una was saying before. A style guide is an artifact of a design process. A design system is a living, funded product with a roadmap, backlog, and serving an ecosystem. So creating a design system in this view potentially means then productizing our way of working with design, but with a process of constant improvement. So the systems thinker sees the system as never done, but constantly in a state of becoming. So normally when thinking about stuff like UI design, we want to be close to the metal, like content first and all that. But this view, if you view the design system as a process, we've sort of taken a step back and we're one step removed. So we're sort of designing design all of a sudden. So the term meta design popped into my head and I typed it into my nearest search engine and wandered straight into the next rabbit hole. So meta design. That's the thing, apparently. I had no idea. But turns out I had heard the term before, actually right here in Brighton. I forgot that last time we met, Jeremy. But John Wilshire gave a talk right here at Deconstruct in 2015 about meta design. It was a fascinating talk, but I didn't quite understand it. I do remember that there was a Pace Layers reference in one of the slides, so drink, I guess. I need to take a drink of water. Oh no, I can't handle these. Sorry. I know how it works. Yeah, there we go. But now I had like reason to go back and try to find some more clarity of what this meta design thing was all about. So unsurprisingly, it's used to mean an expanded scope or higher order layering of design. And that can itself be interpreted in a few different ways. One interpretation, stemming from the world of interactive art, actually, in the 80s, is the possibilities of information technology allowing the artist or the designer not to shape the thing itself, but the conditions for the thing to exist. To give a pretty simplistic example, this medieval fantasy city generator was doing the rounds on Twitter last year. And there's like a whole list of parameters you can tweak, giving an endless variation of output for a fantasy map. So You designed the map, but the context of the map was designed by the meta designers in creating the generator. They didn't design any specific map. So what does this particular interpretation have to do with design systems? That has to do with another thing I found. It's this guy, designer, coder, and artist Rune Madsen from Denmark. He's written and talked quite a bit on the subject of meta design for design system. And he uses it as a foundation for a critique of design systems as we talk about them today. And his concern is that design systems risk creating a monoculture, and we should instead use design systems in a way that really exploits the freedom of working with code, rather than encoding constraints that we inherited from more visual tools. I realize that might be slightly confusing, but to visualize it, we can imagine a scale for the usefulness or helpfulness of digital design tools for coherent design, where that end, sort of the left-hand side of the scale, is too much freedom, not enough support. So, for example, just a general-purpose programming language. And at the other end, there's too much structure and too much templating going on. So he exemplifies his critique of the current, well, this is a couple of years old, so the material design of the day, sorry, Una. He places that somewhere pretty far on like the right-hand side of the scale. There's long lists of do's and don'ts and comprehensive sets of predefined components, and we go for consistency and control on that side of the scale. So the risk on that side of the scale is getting organizational pushback for being too top-down, or worse, that an inexperienced or understaffed design team looks more towards what the design system tells them to do rather than what their users need. So, hypothetical tools for meta design tend to go for the left-hand side of the scale, allowing for a greater freedom for unique and hopefully better solutions, while still planting some seeds, mostly in the forms of algorithms and tooling software, that then should allow the greatest freedom, but still with some kind of consistency of output. So, as I interpret his thoughts, the design system as meta design doesn't necessarily grasp for components as the first port of call to solve design problems, but rather tools or processes that let you explore solutions that share the same DNA. So the risk on that end of the spectrum is loss of control and lower consistency. So, and of course, the cost invested in those tools. Now, I've had quite the hard time visualizing for myself, still like, okay, so what are those new tools? Because it sounds super complicated. The first thing that popped into my head was the grid, like the grid.ai. Does anyone remember that? Yeah, a few nodding heads. So that was supposed to replace designers with AI, so it was doing like algorithmic layouts. You just chuck in your data and out pops a website, basically. That was supposed to be super beautiful. And like I kind of laughed it off initially. It doesn't seem to have like ended really well for them, the class action lawsuit and stuff. So like I was laughing at it, but it turns out like they did employ some pretty super smart people to work on these algorithmic layouts things, and we'll get back to that in a minute. But if we turn to like the advertising and branding worlds, there are plenty of more examples. This short clip is about a logo design for Casa da Música in Porto by Stefan Sagmeister. So it's a type of meta design that is more easy to grasp, and it's closer to the fantasy city generator we saw before. So none of the actual logos were designed, in a sense, but rather the 3D shape and the color algorithms and all the stuff that made these variations possible, along with the supporting tools for connecting photos to logo colors, for example. So algorithmic design and generative art aside, I think there are probably other opportunities where we can use technology to inject both consistency and freedom into the process of creating interfaces without going through the component route, or maybe in combination with going through the component route. The closest example that I sort of could dig up, again, stolen from Rune Madsen, is the React Sketch App project from Airbnb. So it's a library. I'm not exactly sure how it works. I haven't tried it out. But it's created by John Gold, incidentally, one of the people who worked for the grid with the generative arts or generative layout stuff. But In this project, Airbnb created a bridge to export the rendering of React components specifically into sketch files pretty much in real time, so you can sort of change the component, the visuals update. And it sort of might not sound like more than an interesting hack initially, but I think it has the makings of a lot of the benefits that the meta design perspective seems to be talking about. Like, remember how I talked about system thinkers seeing more power in tweaking arrows as compared to tweaking boxes? This is doing something like that. It's actually flipping the arrow of the usual flow from visual tool into coding, moving the source of truth. So hopefully this also mitigates some of the, like, throw it over the wall approach that follows, where, like, the visual design starts out and then goes into code, which has a whole different set of constraints that are maybe clearer. So if you start with code and then start iterating on that in the visuals, I think that's an interesting point. So it places more emphasis on the role of code in producing visual design, but in a way that still allows for non-coders to work with specialized design tools. So visual design can also then be backed by stuff like design tokens and layout algorithms present in the code base, but not necessarily in the visual tool, and perhaps connected to real content through APIs and so on. And all of that, it gets kind of hard to do if you start from the visual side. So I think that's an interesting perspective. So this perspective is all about the tension between the top-down versus bottom-up approach to design. But as I see it, there's a pretty heavy visual focus to it. And the benefits of a traditional component library approach to design systems are probably clear, like solve problems centrally, reuse those solutions, make it easy to use, etc. You want to reduce the effort to produce high-quality design. In this perspective, I think you need to realize that those benefits exist, but it's focuses on the risk or the cost of that approach. So primarily the risk of missing out on opportunities possible with a different kind of digital design, where the sort of fluidity of code plays a larger role in creating innovative solutions. So when we go down the component route, we might end up choking those kinds of efforts as an unintended consequence. I put a link up on the slide. This is, since I was borrowing heavily from Rune's stuff, he's writing an online book about this specific topic, about sort of generative stuff inside design systems, called programmingdesignsystems.com. So I put it up there. So check that out. It's pretty interesting. So that was a bit of the meta design perspective. I have the same problem as Amy had before. I have this weird transition that I need to make. But I'm going to try to smooth it over a little bit. But regardless if we start investigating the meta design route more, a lot of our work is still going to revolve around designing reusable bits of UI. And we need to have feedback loops inside of that system, or however we build it, in terms of talking to each other about code or design. So going back to Airbnb for a second, I think it's interesting that they call their system the design language system, not the design system. To me, a design language is not just how it communicates with users, but also how we use it to communicate and collaborate with each other. So I was talking about that aspect of this at work. When a colleague mentioned, this reminds me of a concept I encountered when I was studying philosophy at university. Which brings us to our next stop, that most wretched hive of scum and villainy, academia. Oh, sorry, that's the wrong slide title. I got carried away a little bit. So boundary objects is our next stop. This comes from sociology. It was created by Susan Lee Starr and James L. Griesmer in the late 80s. The concept, it originally came from a study of how the Berkeley Museum of Vertebrate Zoology, which is super hard to say when you're nervous on stage, and why that museum became so successful in the first half of the 20th century. So you had museum curators and trappers getting specimens for the museum and all these people collaborating. I'm not going to go into super much of detail on the paper right now, but this success, according to the paper, had to do with how we collaborate through the systematic use of objects. So many theories of collaboration focus on individual actors and their relationships. Boundary object theory focuses on communities or workplace roles. So it proposes that different groups can collaborate meaningfully without needing full consensus or even full understanding when developing boundary objects. These objects act as translation mechanisms, allowing us to work on commonalities without completely sharing perspectives. Sound familiar to any type of work you're doing? What makes something an efficient boundary object? First of all, a boundary object needs to have some form of representation in the world, needs to be outside of people's heads and available in some form. Second, the boundary object needs to have enough of an own identity that everybody understands it as its own thing. In parallel, the boundary object needs to be flexible enough to be useful to several different groups without being owned by any of them. Finally, a boundary object can never be effective when enforced against the will of the group. They have to be mutually adopted or even co-created. Sound familiar again? Maybe? So, here's a boundary object. This is a map where some form of externally decided outline of a thing becomes a backdrop for communication. This could be really any shared workspace onto which each participant can project the things that are relevant to them. So a map of Brighton, for example, can describe roads, parks, public transit, and anyone who knows how maps work and what Brighton is can make use of it. They can navigate by it, they can plan their stay based on it, or use it to point out where they were almost mugged by a massive seagull. And I'm telling you, one of those things is going to have someone's leg one of these days because they're fucking huge. But crucially, the map does not dictate what it should be used for. At the same time, it allows for communication around the geography of Brighton to anyone using it, regardless if they don't understand why the other party would use it that way. So we've already seen the map that is called a coincidental boundary. These are the terminology, like the terminology used in the paper. There are other types. There's the repository, like a shared structured collection of many things, like a database, a museum collection, maybe a code repo, for example. So that can then be like analyzed and structured, sorted in different ways that are similar to all of the different groups, but for different purposes. There is the standardized form, which is more like a type of shared data format, which is designed to consider as many perspectives as possible. So for the museum, this is primarily their specimen collection sheet. They need to consider not just what they need now, but like what a future person going through the collections might need, etc. Finally, we have something called the ideal type. And this is something that has sort of abstract commonalities, but without referring to a specific instance. So like a species description, like the ideal form of a species, or a category, I think, could work, or a design pattern. Why not? So it seems like anything from design principles, naming conventions, component libraries, code repositories, they all pretty much fit the boundary object description here. Alla has often made the point, and does in her book as well, that a shared language is an incredibly important foundation for coherent design. And having not just naming conventions, but, for example, a URL where you can read about each pattern and the reasoning behind it is immensely powerful. So I think Susan Starr, were she alive today, she sadly passed on, would definitely say we have already developed boundary objects within design system work, but they can hopefully be made even better. In this quote, Brad Frost is talking about the Style Guide website as helping create a shared vocabulary between all the people who are responsible for the success of the product. Today, I think we often are focusing too much on the how of each bit of UI represented on the Style Guide website, for example. How it looks, how it works, how to implement it. So what I think boundary object theory is trying to tell us that is that there is an untapped potential of these artifacts to explain, discuss, and translate different views on our design outputs, which I think is integral to design system work. And it fits really nicely, for example, with what Amy was talking about before. For the collaboration to be efficient, there needs to be a deep integration with the community who are users of a design system, both in terms of respecting different backgrounds and co-ownership over both process and output. My colleague, Robin Whittleton, who was at GovUK before, said that they used to say this about the design system there. It's the community tab that makes it a design system, and I really like that quote. So we're nearing the end of this journey through my basically my search history on design systems, so I'll try to sum it up somewhat. I recently had the good fortune to see Kim Goodwin give a talk on what underpins and in many cases overrules any design system in big organizations. She's calling these decision systems, and she claims that they, she says basically, these affect how we help hinder our users reach their goals, perhaps more so than our design efforts. So I know I've gone on about like expanding the definition of design systems, but I definitely don't want to expand the system boundary of design systems to include all of these aspects. Again, that would be too wide a system boundary. But I do think in our current use of the term, there is a bit of a disconnect between the top and the bottom of the iceberg, and maybe a too narrow focus about what goes into the top. When chatting to Kim after her talk about my talk I was doing here, she said, it sounds like design systems are a bit of an attractive nuisance. Now, I had to look that term up, and it turns out an attractive nuisance is a legal concept in the US. I don't know if it is in other places as well. But it means if you, for example, have a swimming pool in your backyard and you neglect to put up a fence around it, you might be legally responsible if some neighborhood kid sneaks into your yard, falls into the pool, and drowns. So I think we grasp the potential in the concept of a design system, but we immediately reach for the thing we do best, which is to build stuff. Even more so if it's nicely parceled out bits of work, like components, for example. But if that system fails when we throw them out into the organization without a life vest, that's on us. So, meandering through this landscape, veering into systems thinking, stumbling through art history, and sort of falling over into sociology, I've sort of come across these differing ideas that all seem to contribute something to at least my take on what I think a design system is. And it sort of comes down to this. If we're going to start using terminology like design systems and have them mean component libraries, even if that's component libraries plus plus, we're stuck with quite the narrow definition with all the limitations that it brings. So instead, I think we need to embrace all the work we know has to go into a design system effort as part of the system, not as complementary activities to support the system. So process and workflow, tooling, principles, communication, patterns, visuals, all that and probably more should fit within the system boundary and thus be designed as well. And, well, drink. There's probably a paste layers model in there somewhere, don't you think? To be honest, I like basically threw this together half as a joke to tie in with the beginning of the talk. And yet, when I did put it together and look at it, it was like, it kind of makes sense that someone who is traveling towards design systems would define them by way of their outer layer, the components, the style guide, or what have you. It's what we see first. It's what has the most activity. It's what we do in our daily work lives. But if you're stuck there without reaping the benefits you were aiming for, I hope these meandering thoughts can help you tap into some of the slower and more powerful layers that you hopefully find when you start scratching the surface. Now, I realize that I'm the only thing standing between you and a drink, so sorry to have kept you waiting, and thanks for having me. Bingo!